Welcome to The Human Condition with Lisa Gregory. We've been here before. 100 years ago, the world was facing another pandemic, the Spanish flu. James Rada Jr., the author of October Morning, a historical fiction novel set during the Spanish flu, offers a unique perspective on the current pandemic. Conducting extensive research for October Morning, Rada learned much about the Spanish flu and its impact, from the creation of a business empire for Vicks Vapor Rub to perhaps why women cut their long hair into bobs. He talks about the similarities and differences between the two pandemics and how the earlier pandemic may or may not have impacted how we are dealing with the current one. I think our listeners would really be interested in hearing the synopsis for October Morning. Could you tell us a little bit about it without giving away too much?
Well, October Morning is a historical novel based on the Spanish flu response in Western Maryland. It is a story about a doctor, young doctor, who is more up on germ theory and things like that. And he sees the problem coming, but he can't get the old school doctors to really try and take some precaution. And then it goes into him trying to deal with it when it finally hits. Also, at the same time, there is a street preacher who is actually trying to spread the virus in Cumberland, Maryland, because what happened to him is he actually survived a bout of the virus. And one of the problems or side effects I found with Spanish flu was some people would hallucinate. And this guy hallucinated and thought he was given a mission by an angel to spread the flu as like to be the wrath of God. And so that's what he's doing. And so it's the conflicting stories there going on.
So why set a story in the midst of the Spanish flu? I mean, you've got the Great War going on too, but what drew you to that? Had you always been interested in plagues and diseases? And
no, not at all. What I was interested in was history, particularly local. And I had come across the flu story for a column that I used, well, I still write it actually, for the Cumberland Times News, the local history column. And so I'd written up a two-part column about the Spanish flu in the county. And then as I researched the flu for that article, that's when I realized that it was actually a very big deal. I'd never heard of it. And then I start, going to the libraries, doing internet searches and things like that. And I'm coming across all these stories, and the numbers were staggering. And so I've just, over the years, I've written probably a dozen articles about it and done lots of talks for historical societies and things, as well as the novel.
Well, you know, that's kind of the conundrum, isn't it? Because it's not something that it's at the forefront when we look back at our history. And I guess part of that is because of the Great War. And, I was also reading that, President Wilson never referenced it to anyone's knowledge in public, that it was all about the war and war morale and keeping the focus on the war. And I find that really interesting that something that affected so many people, we really don't know that much about.
It's actually, it is kind of odd. And I think part of it, at least in the start, one of the reasons it's called Spanish flu had to do with the control that governments had over the media during the war.
Including the United States, right?
Right. So the only country in Europe that had any freedom to report on the flu hitting was Spain, because it was a neutral country. And so that's why it got named Spanish flu, because they were the first ones reporting about it. It's not necessarily the first place it appeared in this case.
That was China, right?
I found a lot of interesting studies and books couple books that were written by a man named Dr. Alfred Crosby, who had studied the flu. And he had traced it back to an avian flu in China in late 1917. And because the flu can mutate and jump between birds and swine and humans, that was as far back as he was able to go. And then it was in birds for however long before that. But it mutated from the birds and then jumped to humans. And then it started going crazy in humans. The Spanish flu came in three waves. And the third wave was the least deadly and the least contagious version of the flu that came.
Could you walk us through the other two? Do you mind?
The first wave was the one you had that started in China. And it was in the spring of 1918. It was very contagious, but it wasn't deadly. However, it was affecting people. It was more contagious than a typical annual flu. It actually had some effect on the Great War. There were delays in battles because one side or the other couldn't raise enough healthy troops. And then it moved, well, it kind of disappeared over the summer. And then right around the end of September, it just, the deadly form exploded. And it pretty much popped up around the same time everywhere within just a week or two of each other. I mean, it was hitting in US and Europe, which I've always found interesting because back then you couldn't, there wasn't a lot of speedy travel across the ocean. So it had to have been seeded already in both places for it to finally make that breakout. But that was the deadly form. That was the, they estimate about 50% of the world caught it. And the estimates now, they're thinking it would have been about 5% of the population died. The entire population of the world, not a death rate for the flu.
You know, we live in such a global society now. And how much of an impact do you think the war and people that were traveling that probably wouldn't have traveled overseas? Or, I mean, because, you know, in the early 1900s, we were a bit more isolated. We lived on farms. We, you know, we weren't, you didn't jump on a plane and just for the heck of it. I'm thinking the globalization was a result of, or the this interchanging was a result of the war effort. Would you agree with that?
Somewhat. I kind of go back and forth at times. Definitely the reason it was brought, I think it spread so easily in the spring was because of the war. I mean, that's pretty obvious. It was affecting battles. I think that even though it went away during the summer, it just more like went dormant. Because then I think that's how, as troops were getting sent home, that's how it eventually got back into the United States. Not being a doctor, it just seems weird that, you know, say Joe Smith in Boston's form of the flu mutated in the same way that Pierre's in France mutated into this deadly version, and that those mutations decided to flare up essentially around the same time.
How much did the American public know during this time? Because in listening to you do some other interviews, you were talking about there wasn't a lot of mentions in the newspaper, and you'd already referenced that with the name of it being the Spanish flu. How much did the average Joe know about this Spanish flu and what it could do? And how deadly it could be.
It varied depending on your newspaper. One thing I noticed when I was looking at how it showed itself in York County, for instance, I used to write a history column for the York Dispatch. And so I would use old copies of their newspapers as the basis of my articles. And so I was trying to find some stuff about the Spanish flu. And when I'm researching this newspaper, I'm not seeing anything when it should be showing up until October 4th, when this Pennsylvania passed its lockdown, essentially. When I went over to the Daily Record in New York, they had all kinds of stories about Spanish flu. So one story was painting a really rosy picture, and the other paper, you know, was just doing the if it bleeds, it leads sort of thing. And then sometimes I have to question, like in Frederick County, Maryland, when I researched it there, I think it was on the 25th, there was some mention of some cases of Spanish flu at Fort Meade, but nothing in Frederick County. On the 26th, there's an article, front page, that says 50 cases of Spanish flu in the county. So I have to say, did they all go to the doctor the same day and get diagnosed with, you know?
Right.
I'm thinking there had to be cases that were in the county prior to that, but for whatever reason, they weren't reported on.
Wasn't it a fact that the flu wasn't reportable during that time? How did that impact everything?
The big problem with that is more in knowing truly how many people had it, because those early cases, the doctors may not have reported it, and those people may have recovered. Kind of like we're seeing now, where now they're thinking the COVID-19 was here last fall, but people just figured it was the flu.
Well, with this, you know, with this Spanish flu, there's a big gap just on, you know, how many died. Didn't China underreport their deaths and those that were infected?
That is something they've just discovered in the last, in the last decade. It was not known. When I wrote October Morning, the number was about 50 to 60 million people, most places would say. And sometime since then, they've realized that China underreported. And so now the number of deaths they're putting at more like, you know, 100 million.
Why would China at that time want to underreport?
Perhaps feeling like it could undermine their government.
True.
Essentially is what they're why they're probably doing it now.
Did people 100 years ago handle the Spanish flu better than we are handling it today?
To a certain extent, but I think one of the things that's interesting, both times there were lockdowns, national lockdowns, essentially. But here you've got people fighting against the lockdown because, you know, 99% of the population's healthy, wants to work so they can survive. Back in 1918, even if they hadn't had the lockdown, those things would have still been closed down because they could not get enough healthy people to work the, you know, businesses. They had, I remember I saw ads in many newspapers that said, urging people, don't use the phones unless it's an emergency, because they didn't have enough switchboard operators that were healthy enough to come into work and operate and handle all the calls. So they're saying, you know, they're trying to flatten the curve back then. They were, you know, don't call unless it's an emergency because, you know, we can't handle the volume.
Well, then you had things like, which I thought was really fascinating, and this was totally new to me. I'd never heard of this, the flu orphanages.
The only place I've run across that so far, which I'm sure there were others, but, you know, and I've looked at, Frederick, Washington, Garrett, Allegheny, Franklin, Adams, and York counties, specifically how they've handled the flu. So among those seven counties, the only one that I saw that had a flu orphanage was Washington County. And they set it up. The country club in Hagerstown was taken over by the Red Cross. And what would happen is these families where the parents were too sick to care for their children, and the children were still surprisingly flu free, the Red Cross removed them from the home temporarily and took care of them at this flu orphanage, hoping to keep them healthy. And then sent them back home when their parents recovered. And that's the kind of situations they were facing back then, where, entire families couldn't get out of bed. And people were just withering because they didn't want to eat. They were starving because they couldn't get up and even make themselves something to eat if they wanted to.
Did we take away anything to handle it better 100 years later?
It's hard to say because, definitely flu became reportable because of this.
Right.
But within a few years, as medicine changes and populations grow, even if something would have hit like this in the 40s, I don't know that what they did in the 1920s would have worked. Mm-hmm. The way they were trying to make vaccines back in the 1920s.
Well, they didn't have antibiotics, or?
Well, they were scary. It was using bodily fluids from people who had the flu and straining it and then injecting it. Oh man, it was.
Okay. The cure could kill you, in other words.
It was scary reading about it, but and it really wasn't having much good. So 20 years later, they've advanced, medical machinery's advanced, so things like that, with technology advancing and our knowledge base advancing, I don't know that it would have really helped.
Were there any things in your research that you thought were unusual, or anecdotes or stories, or that you weren't expecting, or just kind of surprised you or intrigued you, that you might want to share?
One that I always tell is that Vicks VapoRub, its popularity comes from the Spanish flu. Before the Spanish flu, it was a $900,000 a year business. Because it brought relief to people with Spanish flu, because of all the congestion and all that they would suffer,
right,
it jumped to a $2.9 million business.
There's always that, and isn't there?
It continued on. On the flip side, Bayer Aspirin was a German company. The rumor was that that's how the Spanish flu was being spread, that the Germans had contaminated the aspirin.
Oh my gosh, really? No, that I hadn't heard. Wow.
Now, the most recent one I heard, and I stumbled on it in a paper, a Hagerstown paper, when I was researching that county, was that it was attributing the short bobbed women's hairstyles that became popular after the flu and into the 20s to the Spanish flu. And it was because women with long hair, because they would have a little bit of worshiping of the porcelain god, their hair would get ruined because it would fall while they were heaving. And so they started cutting their hair so it wouldn't get in their way. And
there you go.
People said that's where that hairstyle started. I don't know if that's true. That's the only time I've ever seen that.
Do you see anything like that coming from this current pandemic? As far as, we're in for some big changes, I think.
You hear a lot about people just doing more cooking.
Working from home. Telecommuting.
Yeah. I think that'll be a bit more long lasting. I think that will hang around. It's always been here in the past 20 years or so, but I think this has pushed some businesses to realize that it works for them to do that, and they'll just keep doing the remote. I know certain industries might have changes made. You know, you might see more space in airlines, cruise industry. They're talking about changes. I don't know how long they'll last. That's another thing these medical experts are saying. Well, you know, for instance, well, if a cruise ship is made for 2,400 passengers, you may only be able to sell 1,200 booking. Well, the cruise ship's not going to be able to make money that way. The same thing with a plane, you know, if you know, either that or they're going to have to double their price to make up the loss.
You know, they say that we get a pandemic about, what, every 100 years? What do you think the next one's going to look like? And will we be any better prepared?
We won't be any better prepared.
Why do you say that?
Because of the time different, the time between the two pandemics. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, a pandemic by its nature is extreme. And you can't plan totally for the extreme.
What was it like to have written a novel set during the time of a pandemic and now to experience one?
Interesting.
I would like to thank my guests for joining me today on The Human Condition with Lisa Gregory. And thank you, the listener, for joining us today. If you would like to know more about the show, please visit my website at thehumancondition.com.